I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 174 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. If you'd like to support this podcast, please go to caropop.com. In this week's episode, we welcome back one of my favorite singer-songwriters, Peter Holsapple. Since I last talked with him in the summer of 22, Holsapple has done a lot. He's toured with his reunited power pop band, the DBs, enjoyed the overdue U.S. vinyl releases of the great first two DBs albums, Stands for Decibels and Repercussion, seen the release of a book, compilation album, and tribute album dedicated to his subsequent band, the Continental Drifters, and perhaps most important, recorded a terrific new solo album. The face of 68, which may refer to a great year in music and or Holsapple's age until earlier this year, officially comes out April 18th on Label 51 Recordings. But you can snatch up a vinyl edition on Record Store Day on April 12th. Whatever and however you get it, you'll be treated to an abundance of Holsapple's smart, melodic, pop-rock songwriting with some extra grit behind it. On his previous solo album, 2018's Game Day, Holsapple played almost all the instruments, but for the face of 68, he lined up a muscular band and has stepped up his guitar leads. If you love his work with the DBs and Continental Drifters, you'll be thrilled to hear him in peak form here. In this freewheeling conversation, Holsapple, who also has worked with R.E.M. and Hootie and the Blowfish, talks about how the new solo album came together. His old friend Don Dixon produced. You may know that Dixon, a previous Caro Pop guest, also produced R.E.M. and the Smithereens. The Face of 68 was recorded over just 3.5 days. On the album's title track, Holsapple sings, "If it was going to happen, it would have happened by now." Has he come to terms with whatever hasn't happened? What does he have invested in what still does happen? Is Holsapple the record-obsessing kind of guy in his new song, That Kind of Guy?
I love Supreme. I got a soft machine. I got the Dave Clark 5. I got Slid Live. I got a Shonen knife. I got repeat when necessary.
How does he feel about celebrating his past with all the recent DBs and Continental Drifters activity? Does looking back help him push forward? He also lets us into his life as a musical person, someone with songs in his head all the time, including new ones that just come to him. Talking with Holsapple is like getting together with an old friend with whom you share many musical passions. At various points here, he offers up obscure yet mind-blowing rock trivia tales, some involving members of the band Spirit and Rockpile, another flashing back on Roy Wood's Wizard and R.E.M. guitarist Peter Buck. As someone who shares Holsapple's love of R.E.M., I thought it was okay to ask him about one R.E.M. song that he may have liked less than the others. Holsapple also offers thoughts on an industry in which agents, managers, publicists, and label execs thrive, while legendary musicians such as David Johansen must turn to GoFundMe for help paying medical bills. This conversation took place before the New York Dolls frontman died. What does Holsapple feel he can and can't do to go out and support the face of 68? It's always a treat to listen to him in any form. Please enjoy. Enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Peter Holsapple.
It's only rock and roll. It's not getting old. There's no reason to quit. So you better get used to it. Get used to it.
Are you the kind of guy in That Kind of Guy?
Oh, if I had a nickel for every time I was asked that, I'd have a quarter by now. Kind of.
So the background is, just for people who are just turning this on and haven't heard the album because it's not out yet, but it's wonderful. It's a collector, record collector guy who's listing all this stuff that he has, and he's pretty good taste. So, you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been on both sides of the music information desk, believe me. So I've been that kind of guy as a consumer, and I've also been the guy who has to wait on that kind of guy at the store. And so I don't think it's a damning appraisal of them. It's kind of an overall look at what it takes to be that kind of guy, I guess, would be what I would say. And the qualifications and, yeah, I mean, knowing the references in the song are really helpful. I think there are a lot of record collectors that will say, "Hey, that's me. What is he doing talking about me?" So then if they come to you about it, you'll say, "Oh, you should just talk to Holsapple because he's that kind of guy also."
Well, there you go. Well, your protagonist has, you know, Randy Newman, Sail Away and Game Day, your previous solo album. So he must have pretty good taste.
One would think. Yeah. I mean, in the Idol Race on the BBC.
Right.
That.
Right? I was impressed by that.
Seriously, I'll ever be able to afford that box, but I'd love it.
I kept expecting you to drop some sort of Shazam move reference because I know that's like in the canon.
It's absolutely part of the pantheon for all of us growing up in Winston-Salem. We just loved the move. My high school punk band, Little Diesel, just did a show. We did a sold-out show in Winston-Salem also, and we must have done 3 or 4 move songs. And it's such fun to play all of that stuff. But we love them, you know? Love Roy. We love Jeff. Everyone.
Well, you know, and part of it is when you're into music and you love music, you're kind of taking all of this history of the music you love into the music you're playing, the music you're making, the music you're listening to. So, you know, there's a Mountain reference in the press notes for your new album, The Face of 68. You just toured with the DBs last year, and they re-released those first two albums finally on vinyl in the U.S., Stands for Decibels and in Repercussion, which I, as a, you know, high school record snob, got the imports of at the time and felt very in the know.
You were that kind of kid.
I was that kind of kid, absolutely. So you toured with the DBs, released these DBs albums. You also, there was a Continental Drifters book, Continental Drifters compilation, Continental Drifters tribute album and events tied in with that. Revisiting all of that, what does that do for you kind of moving forward?
It is great to celebrate one's past. It is great to know how appreciated all of the stuff that's come before has been. I mean, I have to say, there were a lot of people that went to DB's shows on this tour, and I feel certain that they came away from these shows hearing the songs that they wanted to hear and hearing them performed accurately and emotionally. And it's a weird thing. You know, I think about this all the time. I think about like early records that I've owned and, you know, would it matter to Burt Camfort that my first single was African Beat? I don't think so. But if I had ever run into him, I certainly would have said something about it. I think seeing the love for what's happened musically in the past has been really good because it gives me a comfortable foundation for wanting to move forward and do something new. And I've gotten to do a couple of solo records before this, and I've done them in different ways. And I wanted to do something that didn't sound like the DBs or the Continental Drifters. And I think, and you may or may not agree, but I think that I did a pretty good job kind of moving into a slightly harder direction musically, more electric guitar oriented. I got very confident as a lead guitar player by getting to play with the Paranoid Style for a couple of years now. And so that's given me a great sense of confidence. So I think that knowing that the past is well curated and looked after, I feel like at my age, I can move on to something else and do something new and have fun with that. And, you know, I mean, on top of everything else, all of that other stuff has given me the realization that it is hard to go into making and releasing a record with any sort of preconceptions or notions of what's going to happen with them, because you just never know. You never know, you know, something great could happen with The Face of 68. I would love it. Nothing could happen with it. I would be okay with that now, you know. And there was a time when I would be an emotional wreck. I'd put out a record and I'd think, okay, here it comes. It's, you know, just let's make some room in the bank account for all this success. And I'll have the radio on and I'll hear these songs 3 or 4 times in an hour. And, you know, it didn't happen. And that's okay. As the song and the title song goes, if it was going to happen, it would have happened by now. And would it matter anyhow? I just don't even know. I mean, I've gotten to the point where the realization is that I do this because I love it. I do this because I have these songs inside me. I want to get them out. I want to record them. I like recording. I like to play guitar. I like to play everything. I have so much fun doing it. And I still get that. I've been playing guitar since I was 8 years old. So that's 61 years now.
Right.
You'd think I'd be somewhat better, but
no. Well, you're playing all these lead parts now. So, and you got a birthday. You got a birthday coming up.
Yeah, I'm actually going to be in the recording studio during my birthday week. So that'll be fun. That's a good place to be, right?
Is that with the Paranoid Style?
Indeed, more tracks with them, and then we're going to do some recording with the guy that came out on keyboards with us, Wes Lachaud, who is a fantastic keyboard guy and arranger. And he is his real deal is that he is a studio designer. So he designs, he can listen to a room and tell you what the frequencies are that are compromised and help build the reinforcement around it to where it sounds great. He's done that all over the world. It's remarkable. So we were grateful to have him, and he was very selfless about it. And we said, well, you know, one thing we could do for you is come in and be your backing band. So we're going to cut some tracks with him at his studio, same place that I'm doing the Paranoid Style. Nice. So, and it's all 6 minutes from my house. So perfect, huh?
So, and is it important to you, like when you're writing songs? I mean, obviously, you know, you've had albums come out and, you know, the DBs had these, you know, weird things going on with Bearsville, and then you were with IRS, and there was this kind of tie up in between with Albert Grossman and all of that. Like ultimately what's the goal? Is it for people to know your songs?
Well, the goal, I think everybody who writes a song realizes it's in a vacuum until somebody else hears it. In a lot of ways. I mean, you know, it's an interlocking thing that you listen to it over and over and over again, but to get other people to hear it is really helpful because it, you know, they either like it or they don't, and you get feedback or you don't. And when you do get feedback and it's positive, that's great. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel like you're doing the right thing. If you get feedback, it's bad. You're like, okay, well, people don't like everything. You know, they don't have to like everything. That's fine. So yeah, I mean, I have a need to write. I can't not write. I was sitting out in the studio last night, and it occurred to me that today is February 12th, and I started writing, didn't this used to be somebody's birthday? You know, which, of course, it was, you know, they compressed Abe and George into the one day for President's Day for ease of vacations. I get it. But, you know, I mean, stuff like that will just come out of the blue. But I started writing it, and I got four verses right away and maybe a chorus. I'm not sure. We'll see whether anything occurs with that or not. But it's in there, and it shakes loose at any given time. So I just have to sort of be ready to accept that and go with it when I can. You know, a lot of the songs I write them when I'm as far away from a pen and paper as I could possibly be. So that can be problematic, but if it's a good song, then I'll probably be able to remember it. Amplifier is one that came like that. I was walking down Broadway after a DB's rehearsal, and it all just sort of came to me at once. And so I didn't have a pen or paper, and so I had to hold it in my head as long as right. I could till I got home, and then I wrote it all down. So
yeah, you didn't have a voice memo on your phone back then.
No, I use a thing called music memos now, which is why there's a song on the record called My Idea Number 49.
Oh, okay.
When you save something on music memos, it comes up as My Idea Number. And it's like, that was the one for that one. And I was like, this is as good a place to start as any. And so I started writing lyrics about my idea. And you know, I mean, different writers have different ways of starting. You know, some people have got music, some people have got lyrics, some people get it all at the same time. I just have to be a receptor for whatever comes. And it's happened any number of different ways. But well, I just am grateful that the muse has not abandoned me, you know?
Right. Are you a receptor all the time, or are you a receptor when you think, I need to write a record?
Oh, no, it's going all the time. You know, I mean, I have music playing in my head from the instant I go to bed. I mean, from the instant I wake up to the instant I go to bed. And it isn't always what I wanted to have in my head, you know, but I do have it. And so somewhere when I get a little break in there and something else pops in, I can go out and, you know, grab a guitar or sit at the piano and try to pound out some chords. And it helps. It clears it out for a minute. But then the jukebox starts again. And you never know whether it's going to be Tie a Yellow Ribbon or The Rite of Spring.
Oh, don't put Tie a Yellow Ribbon in My Head, because now that's going to just...
Oh, no. Don't do that. Yeah. Although it's funny, you know, of all people, my former bandmate and sometime bandmate, Susan Cowsill, has done a lot of stuff with her brothers recently in the last couple of years, including the really great reissue of Global, which if you haven't heard, is a remarkable record.
Yeah, when I talked to her, that was just coming out, and I was checking it out then. I'm like, this is a really good power pop record.
It's a great record, and we've got all, I mean, it's so many cool people on it. You know, I got to play with Burton Avare from The Knack on there, and, you know, I mean, it was just neat, and they, and Bob had written these great songs, but, you know, she said that when, I guess Tony Orlando got to be friends with them somewhere, when maybe when the Happy Together tour was out in Vegas or something like that, and he was like, I got this. Just I'll take care of you guys. And I loved hearing that, you know. I mean, you forget that Tony had the first, what he had, Halfway to Paradise, I believe, is the Carole King song that he did. Great song.
Yeah.
Back before, long before Dawn.
And then he had a TV show even.
And he did. And somebody, you know, here's another TV show. Do you, is it called FMU? It was an MTV show, and I believe Don Felder from the Eagles, formerly of the Eagles, was the host.
Really? I don't remember that one.
This was brought up to me by Will Rigby yesterday in a group chat that I was having with him and Bob Northcott from Little Diesel about these rock books that I'm getting rid of. I'm trying to disperse my stuff if I possibly can, and keeping it together so it's still a library, but getting it to people who really appreciate it. And and so I was offering these books, and one was the Don Felder book. And for me, Don Felder deserves an award for having one brilliant harmonic in Already Gone that that completely obliterates everything else in the track, all the rest of the Eagles, one harmonic. And you know, many have tried, but only Felder succeeded.
All right, wait, what point in the song is it?
It's after the verse, after the solo, and it's like the after the second line. And I'd have to look up the lyrics exactly, but he hits this harmonic, and it's just like that's the only thing you hear just for a nanosecond. But I can, I'm just picking picture, and the other guy's going like, "Where am I? Where did I go? This is not good. We must all fire right. this guy several years from now."
Yeah, there you go. I'll have to check that out. You know, it's funny because, like, for a long time, the only way you could hear these songs was on the radio. You know, now, you know, when I get off with you, I could go on Apple Music or on YouTube or whatever and check it out and find the harmonic and all that. And likewise, you know, I could listen to your stuff on there, and there are sort of more ways to share it. But at the same time, I think it was on Facebook this morning, I think you talked about hearing She and Me, you know, your latest single on the radio,
yeah,
and having the same kind of thrill you had, what, 50 years ago when you started doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is an interesting conundrum because it is a world in which we are able to get music to more people over different methodologies, be it YouTube or streaming services or what have you, or even the return of vinyl, you know, but consequently, also the deals have been made so that the royalty structure is really miserable for artists and for songwriters. But we won't go into that because I'm preaching to the choir here. I know you know that. I know everybody that listens to your podcast knows that. And I don't want to be just one more guy that sounds like a squeaky wheel, because it's going to be very difficult. It's one of those things that's going to be
true, really, though. I mean, it's like it's something that sucks for you, because finally they come up with this, oh, we're going to reach critical mass and everyone's going to get rich off of it, and then they're getting rich off of it, but you guys aren't, and you're the creators, as per usual.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's sort of been that way. As long as there have been record companies, there have been people making more money. But I always think it's kind of amusing to me to think that the folks that were in ancillary positions to the music over the years that the DBs and the Drifters who are around are really the ones that have succeeded, rather than the musicians, the people that are the agents and the managers and the publicists and the record label prexies and stuff like that. You know, they've all gone on and done really great things. And musicians, you know, I look at that whole situation where David Johansen is having to have a sweet relief fund to,
right.
You know, that shouldn't be the case. It should not be the case that a guy who's done, I mean, they can't even bother to put the Dolls in the Hall of Fame, you know? I mean,
yeah, they just announced the new nominees this year, and Billy Idol's in there, but not the Dolls. So
I know.
It's like an indictment of the healthcare system, which is insane. Yeah. The idea that David Johansen, after all these years, has to, you know, ask for money, and just culture, that, like, why is this guy who's had this amazing career and put his music, and I mean, his music has meant so much to so many people. Yeah. And the idea that he has to, you know, ask for help, is there's just something wrong with that.
Yeah. Same with Chris Wilson from the Flaming Groovies, who's facing,
right. I saw that
right now. That's just not, that doesn't make any sense to me, why we live in a country that's so rich and is, you know, has got these things that they should be able to do for artists and musicians and authors and economists and actors and what have you, that are not making the big bucks. You know, it's always been that kind of weird tiered structure of stuff, where the people that are the blockbuster people make the bazillions of dollars. And, you know, same thing with publishing. You know, the John Le Carré is not hurting for money. You know, guys like that. But I know plenty of people that are writing books that probably sell a couple of thousand copies, and that's it, you know. And that's tremendous. You know, you put some, I mean, I think of making a record. I mean, at least, you know, for the Face of 68, we were in and out of the studio in 3.5 days cutting the tracks.
Really?
So that works for me. So it's not a lot of, you know, but I've been on projects like that Chills record that I worked on, Soft Bomb, back in L.A.
I remember that, yeah.
That record took 6 months to record and finish. 6 months, a half a year. I guess you did the math too, but I mean, what I'm saying is, like, how it's really hard to spend that kind of time. And I don't know, I assume that Martin Phillips, rest his soul, was able to have national health in New Zealand, where he lived, in Dunedin. I hope that's the case. I have to presume it's the case. I look at the stuff coming out of New Zealand. I look at the Beths, and I think, you know, they are so fortunate that they've got a country that will subsidize the arts to the point where they can do these insane groovy videos that are hilarious and fascinating and eye-catching. And it's partially subsidized by the government arts programs. But in the United States, we can't be bothered, you know. The NFL is a nonprofit organization, you know.
No, we're going in the opposite direction on the arts right now. Like, our arts support was pathetic to begin with, and obviously it's going the wrong direction.
Yeah, I don't want to even think what's going to happen to the Kennedy Center. That just all sounds like really insanely bad news. But you know, I don't expect that guy has got any sort of vision of what makes people happy or what makes people feel good. You know, I think it's all the art of the deal, you know, and everybody just gets caught up in that maelstrom. So some people will profit. We know who they'll be.
Right.
But the arts is going to have to, I keep thinking maybe this is going to be one of those things where we're going to have another burst of something like punk come out, and all these people, you know, the Pistols and the Clash and the, you know, or Elvis or the Beatles or something will be born out of this, and maybe it'll be a great thing, but it's going to be really tough to weather for a while, I suspect. So hopefully people will find something, some degree of solace in my record. You know, I was thinking,
yeah,
when
sure.
I went down, I was thinking, boy, what a year to put a record out, huh? But
but you know what though? We need stuff that makes us feel good, makes us happy, and makes us feel empowered, you know? And honestly, you sort of coming in with this big, strong record, Face of 68, this far into your career and life, is it actually is a really life-affirming thing. Because I mean, you posted something where you were saying how it's like, well, people who've heard this, you're sort of being modest, but you know, like, people who've heard this think this is actually the best thing you know, I've done in a long time, and, you know, my parents would think I'm finally living up to my potential. And, you know, it's like that perfect kind of, you know, balance of self-effacing, but also like being honest about it, which is that you do listen to it and you think, oh, this is like a big record. Like, this could have been, I mean, it's not a DB's record, but if you'd put this out after like this, you know, where it was like you singing the songs or whatever, you would think, yeah, absolutely. You know, this makes total sense. I mean, again, it's not a throwback. It doesn't sound like that, but it's in that realm, and it's different from Game Day, which is also a wonderful record, but that's a solo record. That's just you playing everything.
Yeah.
And this is you with other live musicians, and you're really kind of letting it rip in a way that I haven't heard you do on record much, or at least recently.
There was a point to that. Yeah. I wanted to do something where I felt like I was commanding the show with the guitar and the voice. And I feel like I absolutely did that. My wife and I had looked at the shortcomings of Game Day. And I stand by those songs. I still think the songs are great. I think the recording, I got to do what I wanted to do, which was record all the instruments myself, do the whole thing myself. And I see how that works, and I'm glad I did that. But my wife, who is really the smart one in the family, said, you know, you should really think about getting a producer and doing this with other musicians, and we'll find a way to make that work. But if you've got the songs, and after I'd finished writing Larger Than Life, I was like, I should really kind of have a look and see what I've written since Game Day and see maybe there's something there. And when I started assessing things, I found I had about 17 or 18 songs that were kind of in contention, and they were all over the map. But then I got Dixon involved, Don Dixon, long-time hero, chum of mine. You know, I was just texting with him today. And
I talked with him too. He was fantastic.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Talked about you, because we talked about how like Marty Jones had covered What Lonely Is As Lonely Does.
And Neverland. On her first record, solo record.
No, I told him that was one of the things I made me know she was cool, is because I had those DB's records. I'm like, hey, there she is doing that.
Man, that was so huge that she did that. But, you know, Dixon was ideal too. I tried to think of a bunch of producers, and I was thinking, you know, there were other people that came to mind, but I wanted to feel like I had an ability to communicate easily with the producer. And I wanted a producer that I knew would listen to everything going on all at once. That's a hard thing to do. And I've been a producer in the past, and it's hard because, you know, you're sitting there and the track is going down, and, you know, technically you should be listening to make sure the drums are all right. But Dixon's listening to it all. He's listening to the drums, the bass, you know, the guitars, which was all we did at once. You know, we just get guitar, bass, and drums. So I sort of saved him a little bit of trouble with that. But he would come back and say, that was a good track. There's a little rhythmic nudge in the middle that I'd like you to try, and we'll try that. But he overall felt like the production, the arrangements that I came in with were good. We didn't actually rehearse. Rob Ladd, the drummer, and Robert Sledge, the bassist, and I never got together before we set foot into Overdub Lane studio. Although we have played together before at shows. In fact, they were part of a group that backed me up doing two songs at a charity benefit. I did Million Miles Away by the Plimsolls.
Nice.
And Dance Hall Days by Wang Chung.
All right.
I love them both. And so I knew Rob was going to be great. And I had heard Robert for years. But we went in there with – I sent them demos, and they charted. And I got to watch them have that beautiful rhythm section coordination of like they would sit there and compare their charts. And I would just sit there like this, and I would just listen to them talk. And they'd say, well, this needs to, you know, you want to go there with this. And here's where the accent's going to be. So by the time we actually counted the song off and rolled tape. But they can do that now. They've got a 24-track studer that's back in action there. But we did this all on Pro Tools. But by the time we rolled tape, they were completely simpatico and knew what they were doing, and it just it worked beautifully, you know. So it was a great team, and we had this marvelous engineer who works at Overdub too, Jason Richmond, who worked on all the Paranoid Style stuff, and I just felt like he was great. He was you know, he's younger than all of us, and he's got a great ear, and he knows that studio inside and out. So it was marvelous having him and Dixon in the control room for sure.
How did you decide on those two guys to be your rhythm section?
Well, I knew that I wanted to use somebody outside of the sphere of DBs and Continental Drifters. And I live in Durham and we've lived here for 17 or 18 years now. And I've known Rob Ladd for years. Rob actually played drums for the Continental Drifters briefly between the time that the original drummer, the late Carl Annunzio, left the band, and the guy we ended up with for the larger part of the band, Russ Broussard. And so there was a point where I'd been out touring with Hootie, who was my day job for 26 years. And Dixon and Jamie Hoover and Rob Ladd were opening the shows. And I would go out there and during sound check, and I'd watch Ladd, and I'd watch them during shows. And I was like, man, that guy, he swings. He swings like a monkey through the trees. This is unreal. So I thought he'd be perfect for the Drifters. So I said, Drifters? And they were like, yes, Peter, what do you want? And I was like, we need to try this guy out. I think he's really good. So Rob came down, did some dates with us, did some recording with us. Didn't fit with everybody, so we got Russ. But Rob and I have stayed friends. And so we kept up, you know. I'm trying to think. We've probably done a bunch of other stuff over the years as well. But, you know, he's just a remarkable drummer. And he had a terrible, terrible car accident a few years ago and almost died. And it took him a remarkably short amount of time to recuperate and heal up. And Robert Sledge, Ben Folds is another R.J. Reynolds senior high school graduate years later after me and Chris and Will and all those guys. But I wasn't really familiar with Ben Folds 5. I probably am the only person in North Carolina who wasn't. But I did get to see him play with this thing that I did earlier. And then he had subbed in Will's wife's band, Florence Doris Group, and he was playing bass with them. And I was like, man, this guy does his homework. He's great. And then when I told Rob I really wanted to do the record with him, he said, you have to get Sledge on bass. And I figured, you know, if I can get these guys, they're part and parcel together. It's going to be like, you know, it's going to be like tibia and fibula, you know.
There you go.
I'm just going to be the patella holding them together. So it's that great.
Well, yeah, and it gave you the room to do your, you know, rock and lead guitar stuff. So
yeah, I didn't do much lead until Overdubs, but I basically just sat there in the studio and we just went song after song, and I would change amps and I'd change guitars and change settings on the pedal board, or we'd hook up the Leslie for something, and you know, Dixon would coach me through stuff, and I'd say, that I don't think that tone's working. Let's see if you can get a little more treble. Why don't you try the Car Rambler instead of the Deluxe, you know? So I was game for anything, you know.
And did the songs change much when you got them on your feet with these guys compared to what you were hearing in your head, or was it really, this is it?
They sewed up the loose ends. They were able to translate what I had sent them from the demos and make them not too terribly different from what I had done. Again, I did a record where I played all the parts myself. I could have done that again. I didn't really want to. I'd already done that. So this just seemed like a really ideal thing. And those guys are in lockstep with each other. And they all get along famously with Dixon. And everybody loved Jason. And the studio was comfortable and warm. So, you know, it was like a dream team for me. It was like a basketball squad, the five of us.
Right. And Don Dixon likes to record these tracks live. Like, he's not someone who's going to patch together 15 different takes from what I remember from talking to him.
I think he can do it because he's a guy that grew up, you know, with the editing block, editing the quarter inch tape, then editing the half inch tape, then editing the 2-inch tape and stuff like that. So he could have done that, but he put enough trust, like I did with the rhythm section. He put enough trust in the three of us that our capabilities as thinking musicians and listening musicians, he knew we would be listening to each other also. So he felt that we could get uncompromising tracks with just the three of us. And I will say that I don't think there were a lot of extra tracks. Like, we ended up like maybe one or two basic tracks for each song. We did end up using my demo for the title song just because I really liked it. And I like playing drums. I want people to know that I've gotten to be a better drummer.
There you go. Yeah, it's pretty seamless because I read that that was the one you played everything on, but like it fits perfect. It's the second song on the record and it's the title track. So
doesn't hurt.
Did you always know this was going to come out when you were 68? Was that the idea?
Well, it's actually coming out when I'm 69, if not.
Well, yeah. But we're talking when you're 68, and that's what's important.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it all just sort of came together at once. I was thinking, okay, I was 12 in 1968, and that was a really peak year for me because I was going to school. My mom would drive me home from school in her yellow Oldsmobile convertible with the top down, and we'd be blasting the Good Guy radio station, and we would be loving everything that we heard from the Beatles to James Brown to Buck Owens to, you know, just everything that was top 40 radio back in those days. We really loved Paul Revere and the Raiders, you know. And so I felt like that was a good year to kind of celebrate for me. And then on top of everything else, I started thinking, you know, Peter Frampton was the face of 68. You know, he was, when he was in the Herd, that was what the British press called him, the face of 1968.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I said to myself, and as always, I said, yes, Peter. And I said, you should try to get in touch with Peter Frampton and see if he would play a little lead guitar spot on that song. So we worked on it a little bit. We tried. Peter was getting ready to go out on the road, and I know he's been dealing with some health issues as well. You know, although his tour seems to have continued into 2025. So that's a great thing. I'm sorry he didn't get to play on it. I would have loved to have had him on there, but I always think of what could have been.
Was he up for it?
I couldn't tell. You know, I approached his management and I explained who I was, and I got a sort of a terse note saying, yes, we know who you are. And I was like, is that good or bad? And then it just sort of, I never heard it back from him after that. So maybe he just, I have to think that he was busy and really just couldn't devote the time.
Well, when you're...
But I bet he would have liked it.
Of course he would have. Yeah, when you show up in his town and, you know, if he's there, you'll say, hey, come on up on stage, Peter Frampton.
I would love it. I'm hoping if he comes to North Carolina on this tour at some point, I'll try to sidle over to where he's playing and slip him a copy of the CD or something.
So you've never had a talk box?
No, I never have. You know, I didn't own a wah-wah pedal until a couple of years ago. So that's...
I think I get a theremin before a talk box myself.
You know, I love those memes. For sale, use theremin. Never been touched. But I, you know, there are a lot of instruments that I would love to have. I often think in my dotage it would be fun to get a pedal steel again. I had a pedal steel briefly when I lived out in Los Angeles, but it was one of those like 50s, 60s Fender pedal steels that had that's kind of antiquated pedal mechanisms. They were very sensitive, and it was like that sort of deal where you have to put like nail polish to keep something from not unscrewing, so that when you press down on the pedal, it's still going to give you a minor second, you know, rather than somewhere in between. So I thought about it, and it took me, I did a track that was on, there's a track on the 1993 album by the Continental Drifters called Mr. Everything, written by the incredibly talented Gary Eaton. And I said, I can play pedal steel on that. And so I was like, I got to learn to play pedal steel on this. So I came into this studio like 2 hours early, and I just kept like trying to punch little parts of it and getting it in there. And so there's a pedal steel part on it, but it's one of those things where, you know how when you make a movie, I know right. This goes through your mind every time you make a movie.
In my mind, I make a lot of movies. So this
is me too. Yeah, me too. Mine are all just kind of like Disney, but the idea of making something like also with a record, you want it to seem to the casual listener or the casual viewer, in the case of a movie, that this was just like you came in, they all set up, they acted, boom, it's all done. You know,
right.
You don't see the editing, you don't see the mixing, you don't see the auto tuning that goes on with stuff like that, and all the work to get the mixes right and stuff. But the idea is to have a record that sounds like you just went in there and cut it. And I think that this record, partially because it was cut in 3.5 days. I mean, Dixon did mix back at his studio over the period of like a couple of weeks. I would get a track or two from him. So technically it was longer than 3.5 days to make the record, but to record the tracks, and I mean literally all the lead vocals, all the lead guitar, all the overdubs, all of that stuff, with the exception, I think, of maybe a tambourine or two, you know, that were added later just for a little bit of sizzle. But I think that that's part of why that record is going to succeed in people's ears. I think the Face of 68 strikes me as an immediate, explosive kind of record. You know, the part of it is the electric guitar being the focal point. But part of it is the fact that we didn't practice the living hell out of it, and we didn't work out every last job.
Right.
You know, I mean, you have to have a little bit of leeway. I mean, I think that there's not a perfect Beatles song, but they all seem perfect. You know, you start picking them apart, like I Feel Fine, where they sing two different verses at the same time, right? John and Paul, I think one of those verses where they sing different lyrics at the same time.
Oh, there's all sorts of flub stuff and Beatles stuff, and I love that it's there, and I don't care. It's what's human about it.
But the other side of that is, I don't know if you've have you ever listened to some of that stuff, like the original version of Rain, that's not at the speed of the single they put.
Oh,
it
yeah,
up?
Yeah, that's crazy. It's so fast.
And ordinarily,
Ringo is like a punk drummer on that.
I know. And when you slow stuff down, when you speed stuff up, it tightens the performances up a little bit. It fills in some of the holes. When you slow it down, the holes become more evident, and the disparate nature of the instruments should be really present. But those guys were locking even slowed down.
Right.
It just doesn't seem possible that you could slow it down and it would still sound like that. It just blew my mind. I have to thank R. Stevie Moore for sending me that track. Stevie's a great guy and a wonderful talent too. So
yeah, no, Ringo sounds like a monster when you slow it down, and when you play it at the normal speed, you're just like, what is he playing, you know, because it's a crazy drum track anyway, but he was playing it so much faster in real life than even, you know, when you hear it, it sounds crazy when you have the slowed down version that came out. So
I love minutia like that, you know, I just love that sort of stuff.
You're that kind of guy.
I am that kind of guy. I'll give you a little bit of minutiae right here. You know,
okay, good.
You know the band Spirit, right?
Sure.
Okay. You remember Randy California's band Captain Copter and his fabulous Twirly Birds? They had one record on Epic Records. It was him and a bass player and Ed Cassidy. And it was a great record. And it came out at the same time as, I think, like Lane Changer by Michael Finelli, for example. A bunch of interesting stuff came out then. But there's this backward stuff between a couple of songs on the Cap'n Copter record, between, I want to say, the first two songs. And for years, it was like, I have a turntable that goes backward. What is that? So finally, somebody was like, I do. So we're going to do that. And then we rolled it backward. And what it is an a cappella rendering of the chorus of I Can Hear the Grass Grow by the
Moon. Really?
Really.
Oh, that's
is
so
that
funny.
Weird? It's like all these things that just connect. I have a very favorite record right now called Map of India by the late Deke Leonard, who was a member.
Did not know that one.
Okay, he was one of the guys in the band Man from Wales, who you may or may not know. They were part of the group of, you know, there was a point where United Artists Records in the 70s were putting out amazing stuff with these expensive covers. I can think of like two or three covers by the group Family that had just insane stuff, you know, like pages and pages and pages of covers or something that looked like an old radio. Well, Man had a beautiful record called Be Good to Yourself at least once a day. And the art director was a guy named Pierre Tubbs, who was also notable for being the guy who A, married Maxine Nightingale, and B, wrote right back where I started from. And
okay.
He was the art director on this record. And so you open up the gatefold, and it folds it out into this like 24 by 24 map of Wales, this beautiful just like illustration of a map, and it's got every band from every last little town all over Wales. And the great thing also is it's got like people with poles like pushing Wales apart from England, you know.
There you go.
Great. And Deke was a big member of that band. There's a guy, Mickey Jones, who was a great guitar player. Lots of cool people. The drummer was Terry Williams.
Oh, okay.
Of Rockpile.
Rockpile, yeah. They
also played with Meatloaf for years. And
played on Repeat When Necessary, which you repeat several times in that song.
And played with Dire Straits.
Yep. Twisting by the Pool.
He is such an amazing drummer. I mean, any of that stuff that Mann did, and I just pulled out Seconds of Pleasure, the Rockpile album, which I admit I was that kind of guy that said, boy, this could have been a lot better, huh?
Everyone said that when it came out, and then you go back to it and you're like, this is pretty good.
What was I thinking? It's a great record, but you listen to some of those tight little rolls and he's doing this almost like military kind of snare stuff. So, okay, getting back to Map of India, great song.
Okay.
And I'm trying to find out, it would have been around the time that Deke might have used Terry Williams as the drummer, but there's no record of anything anywhere. I don't know who to ask. Deke is deceased. I think we've got a question to Terry on Facebook somewhere. I suppose I could also ask Andrew Lauder, who was sort of the guy that was feeding lots of great stuff to United Artists in the United States. I mean, you think about UA in the early 70s. They had Phonograph Record Magazine that Marty Cerf was the editor of. Totally wonderful tabloid magazine that came out, and you could find that at record stores and stuff like that. They had Blind Date with Flo and Eddie, where they would like rate songs and rate records, and you know, being the traditional Flo and Eddie, very flippant about everything. One of their favorite answers was simply Philip Goodhand Tate, who was an obscure British artist. So, United Artists had Can, they had Mann, they had the Groundhogs, they had Amandul 2, they had Family, they had The Move, ELO, Wizard. I mean, it's just so much stuff. Cochise, I believe, the band with Mick Grabham, who ended up playing briefly with Procol Harum when.
Right.
And also B.J. Cole, the great pedal steel player. And they have a hell of a version of Love's Made a Fool of You, the Buddy Holly, Bob Montgomery song. Great version of that. That was a kind of a hit in England. But, you know, we were lucky. When I was a kid, when I was that kind of guy, when I was that kind of kid, I found a little community of musicians, you know, that had all watched the Beatles on Ed Sullivan that Sunday night. And we all wanted to be musicians. We all picked up guitars. We all started buying records. And there were people like Mitch Easter, who were deeply into The Move early, and Chris Stamey, who was like the first guy I knew who bought the first Little Feat album. So we had a little, Chris and I had a little band that was doing like Truck Stop Girl and Crazy Captain Gunboat Willie when that was new stuff. And you know, and Little Diesel, and we were doing like Teenage Head when it was a brand new song. Rittenhouse Square, the band that I had with Chris and Mitch, we were doing Rock and Roll Queen when it was a brand new song. So the feeling is that when you're in a group like that and you hear these songs and you don't hear them on the radio, but you develop this deep abiding love for them, your thought is, if I were going to have a band, maybe I'll have a band. If I were going to have a band, I would play songs like this and play them for people so that they could enjoy this stuff too. Because if they're not going to hear it on the radio, where are they going to hear it? Which right. explains why almost every band in Winston-Salem did this great Spooky Tooth song called Better By You, Better Than Me. Every band played it.
Really?
And we would go see other bands playing it, and we'd be standing there going, and the band was like, we better play this right. He's watching. He knows, you know? So it was a great, it nourished itself, I guess you would say. We didn't have a lot of totally, you know, and we had the Five Royales and Winston-Salem, Loman Pauling, and, you know, Think and Dedicated, the One I Love. And that was R&B. But there really wasn't much apart from Al Nichol, who was the guitar player for the Turtles. And George Hamilton the Fourth, I guess. Not a lot of pop music came out of Winston-Salem. We did have radio stations. And we had a college radio station, WFDD, and they had Deacon Light on after 11 o'clock on the weekends. And he would hear stuff. So we all found each other, and we started bands, and we hung out. We had a little place at high school called Combo Corner. We would all get together in the mornings and talk about the new MC5 record, or how good is that Stooges record, or have you heard Shake Some Action, you know, that sort of stuff. And it just felt good because everybody else was talking about Idlewild South, and, you know, that's a great record. And the Marshall Tucker Band, it's taken me years to get around to loving that stuff, and I do. But at that point, you just felt like such an outlier, not embracing that only, or Gilbert O'Sullivan, or
you were the Southern rock of Big Star, not Marshall Tucker and Allman Brothers.
Exactly. And when Big Star came along, it was like the veil parted, you know, that was like, okay. And then it's the same thing with REM. When I heard REM, you know, I knew their manager, Jefferson Holt, when he operated a record store in Chapel Hill. And then he went to Athens. I went to New York. We stayed in touch. He said, I'm managing this band. Where do we go to record? And I said, you should talk to Mitch. He's just moved back from New York. He's got a studio set up in his parents' garage in Belews Creek, North Carolina, and he would be ideal. And that's where REM recorded Radio Free Europe and Sitting Still. And so, and when I heard that, I was like, okay, this is people doing it right. They've got sound. And, you know, there's a lot of similarities in how REM and the DBs approached music with the guitars and the energy of the bass and what have you. I mean, I think Mitch really brought that out in them, but not the similarities, but brought everybody's strengths to bear with this.
You were the link, right? Because you're the one who introduced them to Mitch Easter, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so then I found out also, interestingly enough, you know, I was just talking about Roy Wood and Roy Wood's Wizard. When they came to the United States on tour in 1974, they played at Alex Cooley's Electric Ballroom in Atlanta. And of course, that group of guys, that kind of group of guys, all left Chapel Hill that morning, hitchhiked down to Charlotte, met up with our friends in Charlotte, drove down to Atlanta, stayed in a cheap hotel, and went to see Roy Wood's Wizard with the Rockets opening up, no less. So I got to see Jim McCarty and Johnny Badadnik playing with this opening band who were brilliant too, you know? So, but it was like, we were just having the time of our lives. We were drinking and carrying on. And years later, I was on the tour bus on the REM tour. And I mentioned that I'd gone to that show to Peter Buck. And Peter was like, I was at that show too. I think we might've been at the table next to you, because we were trying to figure out who these noisy people were at the next table. I said, that was us. But it's funny how that, you know, again, that's that whole thing of like, you find these bands and they are your totem somehow. I know that I feel like the DBs and the Drifters have been that for people. You know, it's that thing where you may not sell a million copies, but to the people, you know, a million people don't know you, but to the people that do know you, you mean so much. And I feel very grateful to have had that kind of career where the music that I've gotten to play and write and record for people has meant something to people. You know, I mean, I look at the cutout bins over the years and I think, man, these people put their hearts and soul into these records.
Oh yeah,
for 49 cents, you know.
Yeah, no, it's like the remainder table at a bookstore. Just like, oh,
yeah,
it's heartbreaking. Are there you know, cover versions of your songs that have particularly surprised and or impressed you?
You mean people covering my songs?
Yeah.
Well, I have to say that on that Drifters tribute record, having Marshall Crenshaw cover Darlin' Darlin', which is a song I'd kind of tossed off and hadn't thought about for a long time, but he did a beautiful, soulful version of that, which just like sent the hair up on the back of my neck. I love Marshall. Marshall is he's just one of the greatest, you know. I've always admired his ability to craft a song and have those beautiful lyrics. You know, people don't ever talk about what great lyrics he writes, but he just, you know, he puts stuff by you that you don't even notice until years later. So that's a song that's a really great one. The Marty's covers of Neverland and Lonely Is are wonderful. Dixon has done stuff too. Dixon did a really kind of swampy version of Amplifier, which I really like. That's on YouTube. You know, as I say, I'm really proud when anybody takes a crack at my songs. You know, I'm honored and flattered that people would think that much, that they'd want to do that. I know how much it means for me to pick a song. You know, I look at my record collection over here and I think, there's got to be something in there for me to record, right? Sure. Map of India? Sure, I can do that. You know, so, and my plan for Map of India, when I cut my cover of that, is to send it off to Roy Wood and see if he'll play bagpipes on it.
Because a lot of time those covers, I mean, especially in the pre-YouTube era, I mean, the first time I ever heard Big Star's Back of a Car was Let's Active covering it. Mm-hmm. You know, first time I heard September Girls was the Bangles covering it. And the first time I heard You Can't Have Me was your Game Theory. So, you know, it used to be, it's like, you know, the bands were the, you know, the jukebox, because, you know, didn't necessarily, those records weren't necessarily in print at that point, and you had to chase them down.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like part of the responsibility of doing this kind of gig is to work as a kind of a missionary for the stuff that you care about. Also the stuff that made you want to be a musician, that made you want to write that first song, that made you want to write that most recent song. You know, I can look at everything up on that shelf of CDs. I can barely see it because I don't have my glasses on right now, but I can tell you pretty much a song or two on every one of those things that I couldn't live without. And even if I didn't have the CDs, they'd still playing in the human jukebox inside my head until I
got it.
So, but I love it. I love being able to play stuff for people. I love, you know, I miss listening parties. I miss mixed cassettes, you know. Did you ever read Rob Sheffield's book, Love is a Mixtape?
No, I've heard about it and I have not picked it up.
It's beautiful. It's poignant. One of the mixtapes that's in there had the Marty Jones version, I think, of Lonely Is on it. And it's worth your while. Rob's a great writer, and it's just a
check it out.
Lovely, sweet, endearing, poignant. It'll make you cry.
Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's Classic Antihero is the number one selling IPA in Illinois. It combines five classic U.S. hop varieties with bold citrus, floral, and pine aromas. And as the weather warms up, cold time sure hits the spot. This premium lager is an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. The brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. And we were talking before about Welsh musician artists, mm-hmm. and you got Welsh musician artist who's in Chicago and is a friend of ours, John Langford.
Yes.
Did your cover. You've been immortalized by the great John Langford. How did that happen?
Well, you know, he's done so many great covers. He did that beautiful Por Vida record, the tribute to Alejandro Escovedo a few years ago.
Right.
When Al was dealing with Hep C and needed something to supplant his touring income. And he did a great job on that. And he's done so many covers. And then he did the cover for Highways and Rocket Ships by Florence Dorr, Will Reby's wife, that came out of Propeller Sounds. And that's a beautiful cover, too. And I was just like, I was thinking, need a really striking cover. What can I do? And I had this picture of me holding this pamphlet that my parents had, Psychological Defense in Times of Community Disaster, I think is what the title is. And it's got this guy's face on it, the half of the face in black and white. And he's looking like, you know, he's watching a car accident in slow motion. And so I stuck it up to my face and took a picture of it. And I sent it to John. And I'd met John. I actually met John when Paranoid Style played with the Waco Brothers.
Okay.
In St. Louis at Off Broadway a few years ago. And I was so shy because, man, I've been knowing about John Langford since that first, that whatever, that little go, the Fast Products four song thing with the Gang of Four and Mekons.
Wow, yeah.
So, you know, that was in my store. I knew what they were, who they were. He recorded for Coyote Records, for Steve Fallon's label. And Chris was on that label too. So I was aware of who he was. But I was just totally daunted by a guy with that kind of amazing talent as a songwriter and as a fine artist. So I wrote to him. And I sent him a picture. I said, I would love to see if you would consider doing this cover and maybe work from this. And he was like, brilliant idea, Pitt, let's do it. And so we went in and he had it done in almost no time. I mean, he got to come back from some shows, but it was like, it was breathtaking. So I am forever in debt to John and his incredible talent. And I'm here to tell you, that guy rules.
He does. He does. He's constantly in motion. He's mm-hmm. constantly doing a gig with about 15 different bands, and there's a new Mekons album about to come out. So
he's like a shark. He probably would die if he didn't keep moving like that, you know?
So yeah, you should wherever they're going to be, you should have like a double bill of, you know, you guys and the Mekons.
Oh, I'd love it. I'm probably going to have to go out and tour behind this record, largely acoustically and probably largely house concerts, because, you know, admittedly, the 69-year-old new artist in me, which technically I am once more, it's hard to be an opening act, which is what I would be at this point. I've done it before, and I get it, you know.
Yeah, no, I could see that.
But more than half the time, I would say I feel as though I'm this obstacle between the audience and the people they came to see, or the bar, or a conversation, you know, because 9 times out of 10, they don't know who I am. I just happen to be on the bill, you know, when they show up. And it's hard taking a band around. I just don't have the kind of resources anymore. You know, we're still getting paid the same kind of money we got paid in 1982. And, you know, it's
like
hard.
You're a journalist.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I think about that all the time too. I think that the cost of living has far exceeded the wages of sin for musicians and journalists. I'm hoping that I can do that. I'm trying to find some decent shows to play by myself as well. You know, I've got a couple of shows in North Carolina in April that I'm going to do in Winston-Salem and in Chapel Hill to be the record release parties. And I will have Rob and Robert as my backing band. And we'll probably have some friends hop up on stage with us too. But I'm going to do a lot of the songs from the record. I'm going to do some stuff from my first solo record, Out of My Way. And hopefully I'll be able to do some stuff from Game Day also, try to make that into when I've got those guys playing the stuff together, it's all going to sound of a piece. I have no doubt.
If you came to Chicago as Peter Hall Sapple, you could definitely headline somewhere, just for whatever it's worth.
I hope so. I would like to think that I could. You know, Chicago's always been so good to us. We used to be, you know, the XRT favorites, and we got played on that station all the time. And we were so grateful for that. And all the people that would show up at shows at the Cubby Bear and at the...
Right.
I'm trying to think of all the places that we used to play over the years.
You were Metro at some point.
Metro, yeah. We played a thing called Everyone's Birthday at Northwestern University. And this is like in the latter day part of the DB's history. And the idea was, it's everybody's birthday. So we played a lot of songs, and we played Happy Birthday after every fifth song or so. And everybody joined in, and they were drinking like they were going to shut the bars down. And it was so much fun. We did a show at the Cubby Bear, and we were doing sound check, and the Cubs game let out, and the place filled up, so we did another show for sound check. How about that? That is a rock and roll city. To Beat the band. I love it. My family took a trip up there for Christmas, not last year, but the year before, and we had the best time. We just love Chicago. It's one of my very, very favorite places in the world.
Well, Chicago loves you too. So not that this podcast is about Chicago. This is an international thing we're doing here. But
hey, I like Chicago the band, and I like Chicago the musical too. So what are you going to do?
There you go. There you go. Which number is your favorite of those records? Or is it Hot Streets, the one with the title? No. And the worst cover ever released on a major record.
For me, it's a toss-up between Chicago Transit Authority and the first Chicago album, the silver-covered one, the first two records.
Yeah.
I saw them when that second record came out. And we'd already deeply been involved loving the first record. And they came and played in Winston-Salem. And so we got to see Terry Kath in action and that original band. And they were just monumental. They were loud and they were ferocious and they were furious. And the energy and the sweat on stage and in the audience, you know, for a town that didn't get a lot of really noteworthy shows over the years, most of the great shows came to Greensboro. You know, we got Jay Giles over there a lot, all the time. We got so many great bands coming through Chicago, through Greensboro. But Winston-Salem had a couple of really interesting shows. And that one, the Chicago show at the Benton Convention Center was remarkable. Just a remarkable show.
Yeah, so I think people forget what a hot band they were because they think of Hard to Say I'm Sorry and all that stuff from later. But
yeah, I get it.
It was a different thing. You know, Rod Stewart used to rock too, I hear. You know, he's like, wait, he does all that soft stuff. Anyway.
Yeah. You know, I keep hoping that somebody's going to finally put together Rod Sings Bob and get all those Dylan covers that he's done over the years and compile them into a really, it's a great playlist if you ever do something like that. And I mean, it is a great version of The Groom Still Waiting at the Altar, of all things.
Really?
Yeah.
I love that song.
Yeah. Just marvelous stuff. You know, I mean, Hobo's Lament is such a great thing, but that's an untapped, you know, I don't ever have to have, you know, the Great American Songbook volume 14, where he's covering Journey and, you know, that sort of stuff. He's already covered Bob Seger. So
you've got Out of the Way, and then 21 years later, you had Game Day. And now, I guess like 7 years later, you have The Face of 68. Is the rollout of each record different because of the time it's coming out? Or is there like, what are you doing?
It's scheduled in dog years.
Yeah, exactly. It is a dog years thing. What do you do now to get that record out that was different from what you did with the first two?
Well, I've got a record label that is, not that I haven't had enthusiastic labels in the past. I don't want to make it sound like that because my history with Omnivore Recordings is wonderful. And the folks there, starting with Cheryl at the top and all the way down through the ranks, has been nothing short of family. And they've taken good care of all of us. They've had a lot of love for the Drifters also. But I wanted to shift gears and find something different. And so I went to Label 51 because Don Dixon said, you should, and Chris Stamey too, to be perfectly honest. And Chris will tell you this. He was the first one to tell me to go to them. He said, you should talk to him. Bill Hine has got this label. And Bill had run Enigma Records in the 80s and 90s.
Right.
And so Dixon knew him because he'd done the Smithereens records for him. So Dixon was like,
absolutely.
He sort of owes me a phone call. So I want to send this to him. And I was like, So it took him a little while to get back from a pleasure cruise that he was on. But when he got back, he said, been listening to this, love it. Been playing it for everybody in the office. They all love it. What can we do? Let's put this out. So I was like, I like that. And they were kind of an untapped resource because they didn't have a lot out. They'd put out the Dream Syndicate DVD and they had put out a Rain Parade record. And it was, to me, it's like that most recent Rain Parade record is really one of their best. I love it. It's really, really good, you know? And so I thought, this could be really ideal. You know, the enthusiasm is great. I had a friend who had done work with him and he said, this is the label you want when your van breaks down in Tulsa and you need a flat tire fixed. Mm. And you don't have anything left on the credit card. They will help you with that. So I love that. And so I thought, well, let's get this together. We'll get and I got my publicist on it, this wonderful Wendy Brinford Jones, who had done the Lord's work for the DBs for issues. She got so much activity.
Oh yeah, I've dealt with her. She's great.
Wendy's the best in the business, I think. And so I wanted to have her, and I fought tooth and nail, and I said, I've got to do it with her because she's going to be able to make a difference on this. And so they were amenable to it, and we got it all hammered out. And the idea is to try to do stuff, and then we were able to get this lovely vinyl exclusive with Record Store Day for the Coke bottle green glass vinyl for the record. So that is thrilling to me.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Is that the only vinyl release, or is it just that's an exclusive color for the vinyl?
You know, I don't know. I'm a big black vinyl guy. Maybe it's because I was a shoes fan.
There you go.
But I do like my black vinyl records. And it also goes back to the day when you had colored vinyl. It used to be the colored vinyl was really terrible fidelity. But I do remember standing outside of the Ritz in New York when Rick Hart from Ace of Hearts Records, who you may remember from Mission of Burma and the Needs.
The Liars, right?
Yeah, and he was going on for, I think, about 15 minutes about how the dark purple vinyl was the best vinyl, it was the purest. And then there was this police action and people getting shoved up against cars and some kind of, you know, lost sirens everywhere. And they finally got that cleared away. And the instant it's gone, Rick didn't miss a beat. And she went back to that. So I've had that in the back of my mind. And they were like, you know, at Label 51, they were like, you should choose a vinyl color. It's good, you know? So I picked it and it seemed like a good one. So I don't know what the story is on that, but it's going to come out. It's going to be on streaming services. It'll be on CD. I don't think there's a cassette, and I definitely don't think that there's an Edison wax cylinder for it, but who knows?
8-track though.
Check on it in 7 years. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'll find out whether there's a separate vinyl release. But certainly, I saw that on Record Store Day, and I'm like, oh, cool.
Yeah, I have to call a lot of record stores throughout North Carolina and say, hi, you know, do you know who this is? Do you know me? I'm Peter Holzapfel from the music business. I have this record coming out. Are you going to stock it? Please stock a couple of copies for Record Store Day. We'll send people in there. We'll make sure. And you won't be stuck with a box of them, you know, after the day is over. But I'm excited about it. And I'm excited about going out and playing. These songs actually work on acoustic guitar, too. And I hope, you know, if I can work it out, I'm going to see if I can do some shows in major metro areas with local rhythm sections. If that will work financially and rehearsal wise. But, you know, there's people that will play my songs.
I was going down a YouTube rabbit hole yesterday, and it auto fed REM on Arsenio after Green came out, and it was him talking and then playing. It was Mike Mills talking, spending a lot of time giving him this jersey, this Dominique Wilkins jersey, and then you guys did Get Up. But, you know, there's you in the back. I'm like, wait a minute, I'm talking to that guy tomorrow. And you're playing you're the second guitarist on there, and you're saying get up, and then it auto fed part one of it, which was you playing the keyboards on Stand. So there you go.
Stand was funny on that tour because they didn't really want to play it. You know, I mean, there were some songs that REM simply refused to play on the Green tour. Radio Free Europe comes to mind. I think we may have played it once or twice, but Stand was a problem because we all liked it fine, you know, but I think the feeling was Michael sort of wanted to get it out of the way so we could get on to the meat of the matter, or right, in his case, the vegetable entree of the matter. And so we would often start the set with it. And so that all starts with that on the organ. And when we played the Arsenio Hall show, I want to say that was the day of the earthquake also out in California, because I think things were swinging in the studio and we were supposed to, I think we had a day off, and then we were debating if we had to play, we wanted to play the next show that was in the area. And people were like, oh, you shouldn't do that because these people have just endured an earthquake and it's going to be terrible. But we just felt like it was important to do it. And, you know, again, it's that whole thing of like the comfort zone that music provides. So we were very fortunate to have that.
There you go.
We could offer that up to them.
I remember seeing a quote from you, or a friend had seen a quote from you years ago about the song The Wrong Child, and you were not a fan of The Wrong Child. And I'm just trying to like confirm that you were not a fan of I'm not a fan of The Wrong Child either. I love REM. I saw them on every tour from Murmur on. Mm-hmm. Wrong Child, not my favorite. Hair Shirt, not my favorite either. But I love that record, except for those two songs.
I think the batting average of that band is still pretty remarkable, but and it's been probably 3 decades since I've actually listened to Wrong Child, but it didn't really hit me the way it should. There were just so many other bands, other songs of theirs. I did a show last fall in New Orleans with Susan and Russ Broussard, and we covered REM songs, and it was really great. I got to be kind of the rhythm guitar guy and background vocalist and played with these wonderful crack musicians in a string section and stuff. And it was so fun to get inside those songs again. And, you know, some of them I hadn't played. They had me playing mandolin on Losing My Religion, which, you know, legend has it, if you read it in some places, I played the mandolin on it, but I didn't. I played acoustic guitar on it, and Peter played mandolin. But it was fun to do all that stuff. And, like, you know, I mean, all these great songs, it felt great to play those songs again. I got in touch with Bill and Mike, and I said, you know, we're doing this show, you should come down if you can, you know. And they were like, I can't really make it down, but good luck with that. And I showed them the set list, and they were like, that is really impressive. And Susan, who could sing the phone book, of course, did a bang up job. She just did a great, great job on all of those songs. Night Swimming, I didn't really play on that, I don't think. I played a very little bit on that. But, it's just gorgeous to hear that beautiful voice of hers singing that song.
Ugh. Yeah. Yeah, I think that show was like days after I talked to her. And then when I saw you at Old Town School, I think it was like right after that show.
Yeah, so, I had to get out of there and get back up and get back on the DB's wagon for that. Well, I'm just going to put this out there. Murmur is still my favorite REM record. That's just me, though.
It's great. Yeah. I actually do love Fables, by the way, because it's sort of this murky, moody thing, and it was kind of a good time. But Murmur is hard to top. You can't top Murmur.
That's that thing, again, where you have, 21 years to write your first record and 6 months to write your second. I mean, and I don't feel like they compromised anything after that. But that group of songs, they'd been playing those for a couple of years that ended up on Murmur. I mean, I even went out with them solo after Chronic Town had come out, and they were real excited about that. Or maybe Chronic Town was just coming out, and I just hopped in the van with the four of them and Jefferson. We drove all over the Midwest and played, you know, places like Bloomington, Indiana, which really hadn't had any new wave bands, particularly the place that we played at. So it was great, you know, and I just felt like that they were getting better and better every show, and they had the full range of what they wanted to do as a band in place. Same way with Hootie. When they were getting on the label, they already knew where they were going with it. And I loved that. You know, it helps to have an atlas when you're driving the roads.
I saw the DBs open for REM in 1984, I guess the Reckoning Tour, at the Tower Theater in Philadelphia. I was in college in Philadelphia. So that might have been, I'm trying to think whether that was the first time I saw you. I'm not sure.
I think that's the night we did Sloop John B, right? I think
you did too, Sloop John B.
Video of that. And then I changed the lyrics to "This is the best trip I've ever been on," because we felt that way. REM, to us and to all the bands that toured with them, I think you would be hard pressed to find anybody who had a bad word to say about them as headliners, hosts. You know, they didn't do that thing where they'd cut the power to the opening act, or they'd, you know, say you can only use these channels, or you can't eat this food. That's the Bellamy Brothers chicken. You can't eat that, you know. And they were always just really incredibly generous about it. So I'm grateful for that time.
Well, see, and I was into the DBs before I was into REM. So seeing you guys on the same bill was very cool for me. Like, okay. You know, the previous year, they Let's Active had opened for them, and I'd never heard of Let's Active. And that, so it introduced me to Mitch Easter and stuff. And then the next was like, the DBs, I know them. And I think Like This had just come out. So anyway, it was cool. It was the beginning of a multi-decade relationship I've had with you guys. So
we're really grateful. I'm glad you made it to the Old Town show also. I'm glad.
Oh, me too. That is all for episode 174 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Peter Holsapel for talking with us again. We could do this every week as far as I'm concerned. His latest solo album, The Face of 68, officially comes out April 18th. But you can grab some limited edition vinyl on Record Store Day, April 12th. Go to label51recordings.com/Peter-Holsapel for more information. And if you haven't gotten them already, pick up the long-awaited U.S. vinyl editions and remastered digital versions of the fantastic first two DB's albums, Stands for Decibels and Repercussion. They're out on Propeller Sound Recordings, and you can order them at thedbs.com. As for the Continental Drifters, check out Sean Kelly's biography, White Noise and Lightning, The Continental Drifter Story, Omnivore Recording's similarly titled Best Of album, and the tribute album, We Are All Drifters. For more, go to continentaldrifters.com. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swaik, who's the right kind of guy. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You could follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.